From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith.
On this week's show, a Kenyan journalist talks about the dangers of telling the truth in his home country.
I felt that there was a need for someone to intervene on behalf of people who are living in similar situations as myself.
And a look at creatures that may or may not actually exist.
We want to believe because we want to know that there is mystery and there is wonder in this world.
Plus, Kansas City Hindus celebrate the traditional holiday of Diwali.
And even now when we call home on Diwali, people can't even hear us because there's loud fireworks going on in the background.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
Across the Corn Belt, farmland is selling at record high prices. Just last month, an 80-acre tract in Sioux City, Iowa, went for nearly $22,000 an acre. That's five times more than the land sold for only 5 years earlier. Sales are being driven by high crop prices and good returns on farmland when compared with bonds, gold, and even the stock market. From Missouri, Harvest Public Media's Abby Fentress Swanson reports that these returns are enticing traditional investors to put their money into non-traditional investments.
I'm standing here in Saline County on a piece of beautiful farmland, which is some of the best land for growing corn in Missouri. 5 years ago, this piece of land would have sold for maybe $4,000, $5,000 an acre. Now that price has doubled, and this piece of land sold for $10,700 an acre last year.
You want a clod?
Yes, I do.
Howard Oddsley has appraised land here in Missouri for 30 years. Wearing dark glasses and a crew cut, he walks into the middle of a field on this 160-acre tract and bends his tall body to pick up a clod of dirt. As it crumbles in the wind, he explains why this land is so valuable.
This is all very loamy, very productive but loamy soil. A high clay soil will just be like a rock, and that's the difference between the way the soils. And the farmers know this, and the investors know this, and that's why they pay for what they do.
Top dollar. It's not just the value of Missouri cropland that's rising. Farmland prices all over the region, from Iowa to Illinois, Nebraska to Kansas, have been sky high lately, in part thanks to corn prices topping $8 a bushel. That's helped encourage investors with no connection to farmland to compete for their very own acreage. Investors like Steve Diggle.
We paid about $3.3 million for our 650 acres odd in southeast Illinois in late 2009.
Diggle is the CEO of a company called Volpace Investment Management, which is based in Singapore. The firm manages $250 million of investors' money. About 15% of that is in farmland.
This year we sold it at auction. We got $5.1 million. That's 55% higher than we paid. Plus, we got two yields, one of 3.5% and one of 5%. So, you know, as an investment, that, you know, 63% over 3 years is great, and we're extremely happy with it.
But you don't have to spend millions to buy farmland. Physics professor Andy Troopin lives in Delray Beach, Florida. He bought a 155-acre tract for $1,000 an acre in East Central Kansas 2 years ago because it looked like it would make him more money than gold or the stock market.
Farmland seemed like a much safer vehicle to get an income stream, even though if it's not a high income stream, at least it's more than you would get on treasuries at any duration. And at the same time, offer price appreciation or at least hold its value in the event of inflation period.
Troopin bought the land after seeing it online. He contacted the listing agent, who worked for Realty Executives Kansas City, for assistance with the purchase. The company holds seminars to walk farmland investors through things like how to find farmers to rent their land and how to follow commodities markets.
We have a lot of outside interest from Texas, New York, Chicago. I can just give you a few that just called here in the last week.
That's Dale Hermrick. He works for Realty Executives Kansas City, and he used to advise former Senator Bob Dole on agricultural policies.
I've got an investor out of California that's looking at some land. There's really no exception of any state. It's just I get calls and inquiries all over the United States.
Hermrick's driving me to a 320-acre tract of high-quality cropland an hour south of Kansas City. He just sold the land for $3,600 an acre.
I have people call me all the time, and I just simply don't have what they're looking for, simply supply-demand. It's just not there. That's probably one of my biggest issues. I could sell an awful lot more of this land if it was available. And people seem to hang on to something that's making some money and real popular. It's just real popular not own land.
The small supply of land available could lead to a cutthroat market, which may even edge some farmers who can't pay millions in cash out of the game. But does this sound familiar? Back in 2006, a housing bubble burst, in part because of rapid and ultimately unsustainable increases in housing prices. University of Missouri agriculture economist Ron Plain says that farmland is a great investment, but he's also concerned that a similar bubble could be happening in farmland.
When you're at record high crop prices, it's reasonable to expect you're going to stop being at record levels. Lower prices means less income per acre and therefore less ability to pay for farmland. So yes, that's a very real possibility and a concern for investors.
Should a bubble burst, farmland might be harder to sell, especially compared to other more liquid investments.
Farmland is unique. Every parcel is different, and if you want to buy or sell, you'll find it's a long, slow process. So that becomes a real negative for a lot of people who are trying to move between different types of investment to capitalize on what's got the greatest return at the moment.
But investors argue that any bubble is still far off and believe that farm acreage will remain a solid, long-term investment so long as the demand for food continues to grow. Abby Fentress-Swanson, Harvest Public Media.
For an interactive map that shows the 10-year change in cropland values in the Corn Belt, go to harvestpublicmedia.org. Still to come, a Kenyan journalist's long journey to Kansas City. This is Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. A free press tends to be something journalists take for granted as part of American democracy. But around the world, journalism can have life-threatening occupational hazards. Before coming to the U.S., UMKC Communications Studies major Peter McCory faced down death as he worked as a journalist for The Standard, Kenya's oldest newspaper. After surviving 10 years of intimidation, brutal beating, and imprisonment, a friendly press fellowship landed him at the Kansas City Star in 2005. Susan recently spoke with McCory.
My name is Peter McCory. I'm a student, a communications major student at UMKC.
So, Peter, where are you from in Kenya?
I come from Kisii in western Kenya. Kisii is spelled as K-I-S-I-I.
And what was it like growing up there?
I was born and raised in poverty, and so even my schooling was quite very, very difficult.
How old were you, first of all, when you first got into journalism?
I was a very young person. As a matter of fact, I started writing when I was in high school. My first story in the national newspaper in Kenya, The Standard, appeared in 1991. When I was completing my high school.
Describe a little bit about the condition in your country when you first started writing articles.
Given the nature of life that I grew up, as a matter of fact, and I repeat this, it was a case of abject poverty. And I felt that there was a need for someone to intervene on behalf of people who were living in similar situations as myself.
Now, I know I've read that you said that the political establishment didn't like Peter McCory's style of journalism. What was the trouble with your style?
You see, you live in a country where corruption, mistreatment of people, like abuse of human rights, is the order of the day. I've continued to do that which the political establishment did not consider a very good or a positive thing to do. I investigated the corruption. I investigated the violation of human rights. I investigated this government-sponsored cases of violence. And all these things put me in a collision situation with the government officers in Kisii.
Now, as you will talk about a little later, journalism can be a really dangerous undertaking. What gave you the courage to persist writing stories about corruption when you knew it could be dangerous?
At one time, when my father discovered that I had become a target of the police harassment and the detentions without a trial, and asked me, at that time he had not died, in 2001, he asked me, "Can you stop this?" I said, "I will not stop. I have a duty to fulfill. I have a calling." And so when you are in journalism, and I get it in myself, you kind of feel like there is a mission that you have to accomplish. And that mission is inside you. And every time I got arrested, detained, in fact, I was arrested the first time in 1994 when I was very young. And I thought, oh, I could get out of this. But as soon as I came out of prison, I again went investigating and reporting, you know, about this corruption and violation of human rights. And again, I got into problems.
Well, let's talk about the arrest in 1994. How did your arrest first start happening? What happened then?
I reported the case of tribal clashes in the Rift Valley of Kenya. The Rift Valley is known to be a hotbed of Kenyan politics and also a center of tribal animosity. So I reported about killings which had happened that time. And the following day, no, the very day when the story appeared in the Standard as headline news, I was arrested with the bureau chief of Nakuru, and we were detained. The following day, we were taken to court and charged with engaging in subversive activities against the government of Kenya. But you know, what we reported is true, because even at the time we were arrested, clashes were going on and people were being killed.
And so what happened with that charge ultimately?
It was discontinued. In a way, they felt that I was out of control. But I don't think I was out of control, because if I found myself in the same situation, I would do exactly what I did in 1994, 95. So this time was in 1998, when I went to report the violence which happened in my home area, where 12 people were lynched that morning in broad daylight.
By the government?
No, by young men in the village, you know, who went out of control and said, "We are going to lynch witches," you know, like the lynching of witchcraft, whatever that means. So when I got there, I took pictures of the victims who had, some of them were smoldering, and the pictures appeared on the Standard the following day. And the police and the local administration didn't like that. I got a call from the BBC to go and make or do a follow-up on that story. And when I went there, the police arrested me. And they took me into detention. And the following day, I was flabbergasted to, you know, to discover that they brought charges of that I was found being in possession of 100 liters of illicit brew, traditional brew. And I was like, I was still having my cameras, my recordings. And I was upset, and I told the magistrate that this charge is absurd, and Indeed, if justice is to be done, the police who have brought this stuff to court, putting it on me, should be the ones who should be charged with this offense. And I was sent to prison for 5 days. And then some friends of mine came up and, paid bail for me. I came out and I hired a lawyer on my own. The case was prosecuted, and this was the only case which I faced the prosecution for 6 months. And I won. The court said, we know him as a journalist in this town. The police are clearly using the court to settle, malicious scores on him. And so I sued the government for that.
Now, did you win?
I did.
So in 2003, though, everything changed and things really escalated for you as far as your legal situation. Tell me about the phone call that you received in 2003.
So on the fateful day when someone called me at 6 o'clock in the morning to report to me that two chiefs had been murdered, or rather killed, in our area, I was like, oh my goodness, what happened? Quickly, I picked the phone and telephoned the district commissioner. Obviously, he had already left to the scene. It was very early in the morning. So I woke up, prepared myself, and the caller came to pick me up from my house. So when we got to the scene, we found the DC was present, the entire district security committee was there, and I saw somebody being bludgeoned violently with machetes, and I pulled out my camera to capture the incident, and that is the time I was arrested.
And then from there, that's when the horrors began.
That was the beginning of a very long journey that was horrendous.
What happened from there?
These guys came to me in a very friendly manner, the police, and they told me, oh, Peter, the district commissioner wants to speak to you. This was a trick to get me, and I did not know. They drove me for 10 kilometers, to the district headquarters and took me to the police station and asked me to wait for further orders. After a few, minutes, a telephone call came to the deputy criminal investigations officer of the district and instructed him that I should be taken into custody. So I asked him why. I don't know, but I'm told that you participated in a robbery with violence incidents in your home area last night. And I was like, what are you talking about? Because it sounded a big joke, as it does to this day. And that night, the policeman came, called me out of the cell, handcuffed me and, threw me into a pickup truck, Land Rover, and I was driven into an area which is far away from civilization, if you like. I was kept there, that night, and then the following day, the whole day, and the third day, I saw a contingent of policemen come, armed with wooden, boards and a rope. So I sat, waited. Someone who had been arrested on the same allegations was called out of the cell because we were put into separate cells. He was interrogated in a next room, and I was listening. And After some time, I heard a loud bang. Pah! Then this guy started screaming. They beat him for several hours. So it came to my turn, and I walked there when they called me, and I told them, I'm going to cooperate with you. Every question you ask me, I will answer the question in the most honorable manner, because I have nothing to hide here. So they started asking me about my connections with that militia, which I was complaining about. I had informed the DC about. They asked me whether I was a member of the militia. They asked me whether I knew that the militia had killed the two chiefs, and I said no. First, I told them I have never been a member, and I can never be a member of a criminal gang which kills people. I am a professional. They did not seem to acknowledge that. I kept answering my questions in the best way that I could. So they told me, you are lying. They stripped me naked and ordered me to sit down on that. Then they tied my feet with the rope and started beating me up. And I thought it was a joke. They beat me up in a very, very vicious manner. They kicked me, they pushed me and shoved me against the walls, and I thought they wanted to kill me. I had never felt the pain that I felt that night. The following day, I couldn't walk, I couldn't sit, I was just like garbage. The following day, I was made to record a statement on whether I had participated in this heinous act, which of course I denied. I said that I knew nothing about this. I was in that area in my capacity as a journalist. They took me to the main police station in Kisii town, and I was kept in the cells. When night came, I was again moved out of the cell, you know, harassed. I was not able to walk, but they pushed me and kicked me and said, you have to walk. You have not been beaten. We are going to beat you properly. You've not been beaten up. Of course, my relatives didn't know where I was. So I knew, since my relatives didn't know where I was, I would be killed. So they took me in the cover of darkness, drove me towards Lake Victoria. And before we got there, they stopped in the midst of a forest. And they, you know, they came out with their guns and said, now, we want you to know that your time has come to die. And the senior officer asked me, Makori. Of course, they called me Makori. Did you at any one time know or imagine that you would find yourself in the hands of the police? Do you know how much negative stories you have written about the police? Now this is your last time. Say your last prayers. Say your last prayers. And of course, I said my last prayers inside my heart. Of course, I knew that they're just going to kill me. Then, strangely, they just stared at me. I was injured. I couldn't do anything. Then, all of a sudden, he just decided, the commander decided, let's go. Then they threw me back into the vehicle and we continued.
You have any idea why they spared you?
It has never come to my knowledge why they did this.
And I know that after a judge got your case, you got sent to a really, really notoriously bad prison.
That prison was the worst ever anybody would want to find himself in.
What were the conditions like?
Very bad. very, very bad, you know. You have cockroaches, you have, you know, lice, you know, those small biting insects, mosquitoes in the night. The food was very, very bad, you know. Food that was as bad as that which pigs cannot even feed on. And the water was contaminated with sewage. That was very bad life. You know, sometimes you don't want to remember, but you know, it happened, it happened.
What kept your sanity and your resolve during this horrendous period?
I have always asked myself how I got out of it, because everybody believed that my life was gone.
Because a lot of people that went to that prison didn't survive it.
Yeah, they died. Good number that died. A good number of people died, and I saw people die every morning. They were taken out of their cells. Their bodies were shipped out every morning, and it didn't bother anybody. Some of them thought that I think there's one officer who spoke to me one morning and said, "Makori, life in prison for you would be very easy if you stop acting as a human rights defender in prison." And I told him, I have not purported to speak on behalf of other people. I'm saying these conditions are unacceptable. But how did I survive? By the grace of God. I always believed that, innocent as I was, somewhere along the way, somebody will see that this is an innocent soul and come to my rescue.
How did the rescue happen? Because I know Amnesty International got involved and others.
Got involved. 30 human rights organizations in Kenya got involved. Some people, like there's a former diplomat who was very, very close. She was a very honest person with wide connection of network. She spoke to people, wrote letters on my behalf, making petitions and you know, bringing out the truth about my situation. Human rights people came to prison, spoke to me, and they documented the information. And the Attorney General just decided that I was innocent and ordered that I should be set free.
Let's go to the day you were set free and released. Mm-hmm. What was your first reaction?
My reaction was I had, at least at long last, gotten myself out of the dungeons of hell alive. But of course, I knew that the road ahead was going to be rough. First, I had the responsibility to inform the public what happened and expose some of the things which happened during and before my arrest and detention. I can tell you that up to quite recently, I wrote a letter to the Attorney General in Kenya and asked him that I intended to have that case of the killing of those two chiefs, where I was falsely accused of having been an accessory, should be, investigations on that case should be reopened, and I would be willing to give evidence. Now, at what point did I come to apply for asylum? After staying out for about 1.5 years, I got this program, the Alfred Friendly Press Fellowships, based in Washington, D.C. And somebody from New York asked me if I could be interested to make application to that organization. This organization sponsors journalists from transitional democracies to come to America to see, learn how journalism and the democracy happens in developed democracies. And so I went through the process of application, interviewing, and I got through, and I came here. So when I got to America, I had already, you know, sued the government, the commissioner of police, the attorney general, officers from the office of the president, and all those who were involved in arresting me and detaining me. The Kenya National Commission on Human Rights had constituted a quasi-judicial tribunal to try my case against the government. And so they sent summons for me to appear and give evidence. So when I left America and arrived in Kenya, the day before the hearing of my case, two people that I intended to call as witnesses were brutally murdered to send a message that we'll catch you. But I was there. I said, yeah, they have killed the witnesses, but I'll be there. And there I was. I appeared before the commission. I gave the evidence. And the government was ordered to pay some little compensation, which it has not done. And so, while in the program, the Alfred Friendly Press Fellowships, because I was posted to the Kansas City Star, it became apparent that my going back to Kenya might not be tenable. And so we agreed with the directors of the program that I should remain in America.
So how do you go through these horrible experiences and not be bitter, angry at mankind?
Life is very interesting, eh? And sometimes you would want to believe that human beings are animals. The animalistic tendencies among human beings is seen when they act aggressively and brutally against the fellow human beings. And so, aware of that fact, I bear no grudge against anybody. But you feel bitter, you feel hurt, you would want to seek redress in a just manner, and that's what I have always done.
Peter McCrory is a communication studies major at UMKC. He hopes to study public administration so that he can impact human rights on a global level. Coming up, the blurry line between creatures that don't exist and the ones that do. This is Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Alex Smith.
And I'm Susan Wilson.
For the past couple months, we've been bringing you clips of presentations from Nerd Nights, which happen in Kansas City, Lawrence, and all around the world. Past featured talks include how to raise silkworms and the character trope of vampire boyfriends as it's evolved in popular culture. Nerd Night KC is hosted at Mini Bar on Broadway Boulevard every month. The presentation we're featuring tonight is from John January, who is the executive creative director at Sullivan, Higdon & Sink, an integrated marketing firm in Kansas City. His nerdy topic, Beloved Monsters, a cryptozoological view of the world. John believes that the creative mind is filled with monsters, To keep them at bay, he seeks the truth about the monsters that maybe, just maybe, surround us in the physical world. Here he is.
For those of you who may not be totally familiar with the term cryptozoology, what it really means is it is the search for unknown animals. It is the science behind finding what people in this field call cryptids, animals that are undiscovered. I think it's important to sort of start with animals that we recognize were once cryptids and are now recognized by science. So if you take a look, the mountain gorilla was not recognized by science until 1902. Just this year, a new monkey was found. This is affectionately known as the sneezing monkey. Anytime it rains, this monkey sneezes, and that's because it doesn't have a nose. But honestly, a new primate just found this year. Famously, the coelacanth. The coelacanth is a big oily fish that the fossil record said was extinct. Every scientist ever, up until 1938, was like, yeah, that we're done with that thing. And it was rediscovered. It was hauled in by fishermen in 1938. So the fossil record was wrong. The coelacanth is not extinct. It still exists. So I think, you know, we sort of feel like we've got the world cataloged. We've got it nailed. We know what's here. But in truth, there are species that are discovered every single year, and it's not all millipedes and weird Amazon spiders. You can find primates still to this day. So it is sort of possible that these cryptids are around, and that's sort of what makes cryptozoology interesting, and that's why, you know, people pursue it. What you see here is a recreation of an animal called Gigantopithecus. Gigantopithecus, not made up. Absolutely real. It was found throughout the world. And, you know, it's a giant ape. It's a giant, hairy primate, much larger than anything that we have today, much larger than a mountain gorilla. And it was actually a contemporary of Homo sapien. So we have been on the planet with this thing. And so perhaps it still haunts our nightmares. Perhaps that's where some of the stories of the giant wild man sort of come from. Here in America, we call this guy Sasquatch or Bigfoot. That's what we call it. Now, these are the states that you're going to see the most Sasquatch in. Not surprisingly, these are also the states that are the most heavily forested, have at least some kind of hilliness or mountainous. Now, this is not a complete list, because even here in Missouri, has anybody heard of the Momo? And in different parts of the country, in Florida and Louisiana, which is not listed here, but Louisiana is actually a hotbed of this kind of stuff, they call it the swamp ape or the skunk ape or the stink ape or anything like that. We're not the only ones that have these legends. Obviously, in China and Nepal, we've got the Yeti. In China proper, we've got what's called the Yeren. In Australia, we've got the Yowie. So across the world and across cultures and across societies, there's something in the race that is uncomfortable with what's in the woods. There's something there that bothers us. There's something there that feels scary. So that's what we call the hairy bipeds in the cryptozoological world. But turns out we're sort of scared of more than just the dark woods. We're also pretty scared of the water. So there are a lot of water monsters that we can talk about. Now, sea serpents proper are something that we've been dealing with ever since we went to sea. The legends of the Kraken, actually pulling ships down, all that kind of stuff. That's been around ever since there've been sailors. So the most famous water monster is actually what's known as a lake monster, and of course that's Nessie, the Loch Ness monster. So Loch Ness is a little bit out of vogue with those in the cryptozoological world. There are those that say, well, Nessie's probably dead. You know, the population there has probably died out. It's getting harder and harder to defend. But what's alive and well is Champ. Champ is actually Loch Ness's or Nessie's American cousin. Champ resides in Lake Champlain, which is a really big lake that is in New York State and borders Vermont as well. Champ's Canadian cousin's called Ogopogo. Ogopogo. is in Lake Okanagan, which is in British Columbia. And Ogopogo has kind of a pretty close cousin that swims off the coast of Seattle and up the coast of British Columbia. And that guy's called Caddy, or the Cadberosaurus. So beyond that, you know, another big bucket of cryptozoology is something where I kind of like to call them the nightmares. They're kind of ghostly and kind of ghouly. And you know who I'm talking about. There's Mothman. So these are the ones that usually have glowing red eyes. Everybody know Mothman? Everybody know the story of Mothman? Point Pleasant, Virginia, mid-60s. Everybody started seeing this weird Mothman creature. It had big wings, big glowing red eyes, really scary, bad Richard Gere movie, right? People were seeing the Mothman, and not long after these sightings began to become really, really prevalent in the area, the Silver Bridge collapsed, and actually collapsed with cars on it. It was a terrible tragedy. People died. And so Mothman sort of became associated as a harbinger of death, or this, you know, sort of, you know, physical representation of, you know, of a demon or bad luck that had kind of come to the town. So, but this kind of guy gets translated into a lot of different places. Puerto Rico, in Mexico, we've got El Chupacabra, a.k.a. the goat sucker, a vampiric little creature that is often feeds on goats and sheep and other small ruminants. We've got the Jersey Devil, which is, again, with the horse head and the wings, apparently the spawn of an evil woman that haunts the woods of New Jersey. We've got the Dover Demon, which is kind of a gray alien type, little, but this is smaller, so this guy was only like a foot and a half tall, and people were watching him slink along stone walls and, you know, Dover. So that's kind of how that goes. And I also lump into this group guys like Spring-Heeled Jack. This is an etching from a London newspaper. He's got the horns. He's got the wings. He can breathe white fire. This guy apparently liked to run around London's parks and rip women's blouses off. That's all he did. Didn't go any further than that, because he was a Victorian monster. But, and sort of in this same class was this thing called the Mad Gasser of Mattoon. And this is Mattoon, Illinois. In the 1940s, people reported, you know, they didn't have air conditioning, so they'd leave their windows open or they'd leave their doors open and just have their screens open. And they began to be attacked by this sort of weird prowler guy that would come up to their windows through their doors and then somehow release this really sickly sweet gas that would permeate their entire home, and they would become nauseated or they would pass out. It was just, you know. So one of the explanations that people talk about is a term called pareidolia. And it talks about our brains are conditioned to fill in the blanks. We're conditioned to see patterns and make sense of things. That's what our brains do. It's why we're really good at Wheel of Fortune, right? Because we go, oh, well, I know what that is, right? Because we can fill in those blanks. It's also why, you know, we can see faces and, you know, and toast, right? It's why we can see dogs in the clouds. All this stuff, it is our brain filling out patterns. That's kind of how it works, and that's part of the reason why we see something in the woods or we see something in the water, and our brains can really paint a really vivid picture of something that's not there. It's not there, but our brains will say that it is. Now, another thing about this is that this talent is an evolutionary advantage, right? Because those who assumed it was a rock and not a bear were killed. And that's a survival instinct, and that's really an important one. And so we're sort of all there. So that's why we're sort of programmed to believe in these things. But in truth, I think that most people believe, and I want to say right now, despite everything I've shown you, I believe. And I'm a lot like Fox Mulder from the 1990s hit series X-Files. You know, I want to believe. You know, we want to believe in this stuff. We want to believe because we want to know that there is mystery and there is wonder in this world. And that no matter what Google says, they cannot predict what we're going to do with their algorithm, right? We are not that simple. We are not that uncomplicated. And the world is bigger and grander than science might tell us. And we want to believe because, guys, it's more fun to believe. Thank you very much.
John January on pareidolia, cryptozoology, and the beloved monsters in our minds and in the physical world. He presented at Nerd Night KC earlier this fall. For Casey Currents, I'm Suzanne Hogan.
This coming week, Hindus and Indians around the world will celebrate the 5-day holiday of Diwali. Back in 2010, Sylvia and Alex teamed up to find out how the holiday is celebrated in Kansas City.
We're in the middle of the 5-day Hindu celebration of Diwali. What you hear are fireworks from Saturday night in Shawnee outside the Hindu Temple and Cultural Center. The Hindu community was gathered there to celebrate Kansas City's biggest ever Diwali party. Some 2,000 people came, double what the temple expected. Earlier this week, Casey Currents' Alex Smith went to the Hindu temple there in Shawnee to find out more about the holiday known as the Festival of Lights.
It's a Wednesday evening at the Hindu Temple and Cultural Center, and a handful of members are taking part in a twice-daily prayer service. Inside the sanctum, there's a huge white-tiled altar festooned with orange, blue, and red paper garlands. The altar's lined with niches containing marble statues of Hinduism's many gods. About 30 of these statues line the walls and wrap all the way around the back of the altar. A priest leads chants and offers blessings while parishioners ring a pair of bells and take turns holding candles. Tomorrow, temple members will start preparing for Diwali, the biggest celebration on the Hindu calendar. It's a holiday remembered by Indian-born Hindus as a time for food, family, and lots of fireworks.
We used to kind of, you know, plead with our with our dad, mom, and say, can I get this one? Can I get one that's something more powerful? And finally, we kind of get a collection of fireworks. So for kids, that's the major attraction is fireworks. And then on the day of Diwali, we, you know, yeah, we would be up at like 3 or 4 in the morning. If you're not up, the neighbor's firecracker is going to wake you up anyway.
That's Temple Vice President Srini Bhagavan. Born in South India, he says he's glad that the Shawnee Temple allows his American-raised children to learn the traditions of Hinduism. But until this year, Diwali in Kansas City has had no fireworks, and he thinks his children have been missing out.
It's like imagine Christmas without lights. You know, it would have the exact same effect if we celebrated Diwali without fireworks.
Fireworks on Diwali are about more than just explosions and loud noises. They have a religious significance on a holiday which is known as the Festival of Lights. According to one of many Diwali Hindu myths, Lord Rama, who is an incarnation of the supreme god Vishnu, was forced into exile for 14 years. During this exile, he fought and defeated the demon king Ravana. It's a new moon on the night Rama was supposed to return home and too dark for him to find his way. So the people of his homeland set out oil lamps so he can find his way home. Today, the Festival of Lights includes lamps, candles, and fireworks. According to President Ravi Mira, Diwali is also now celebrated by Buddhists, Sikhs, Jains, and just about everyone else in India as a cultural holiday.
It represents essentially a desire of light, an intrinsic determination to combat darkness, and the inherent compulsion for freeing oneself from all that is narrow. Mm-hmm. It's a renewing the confidence among the individuals that there's a new beginning. You know, Diwali is something where it brings new hopes, new aspirations. It's a renewing your ambitions and something that yes, I'm living for, and I'm so it's celebrated in complete festivity.
Diwali is a national holiday in India, and everyone has 5 days off school and work. Mira says that now many Indians have switched from living in extended families to nuclear families. This is especially important as a time of reunion. Diwali is full of family traditions, like the fifth day of Bhai Dooj.
It's one day when wherever I am, I always make sure I call my sister, or she calls me and we talk for hours. Bhai Dooj is basically when brother and sister, they actually renew their vows and they say, okay, you know, I'm going to protect you and I'm there. Whenever you want me, I'm there to help you out.
Kansas City's Hindu temple began in 1982. That's when three Hindu families decided to start a temple to serve about 150 families living mostly in the southwest Kansas City suburbs. With nearly a billion followers, Hinduism is an incredibly diverse religion with over 300,000 deities and widely varying traditions throughout East Asia. So as new families have arrived in Kansas City, they've brought with them regional gods and practices. The temple now even has two priests, one from North India and one from the South, to accommodate all the practices. Ravi Mira says what's resulted is a patchwork quilt of Hinduism.
I'm from North India. I'm from New Delhi. And New Delhi being the capital of India, we were exposed to a lot of customs and all, but never as much as I would say in Kansas City, you know. And because when I came to this temple, I was able to see and experience programs, ritualistic as well as cultural, which I have only seen them on televisions before.
Today, nearly 30 years after the temple began, it serves several hundred families in Kansas and Missouri. A few years ago, they expanded the building to include classrooms and a giant event hall. The temple has also been reaching out to help those beyond its community, like in a recent Haitian earthquake relief campaign. But with the costs and local laws to deal with, this is the first year that a Diwali-worthy fireworks celebration has even been considered. Here's Srini Bhagavan.
Having fireworks, for example, professionally run fireworks, was so far out in the left field that people didn't even kind of think about it for the longest of times. And they said, you know, what we'll do is we'll just finish the religious aspects of Diwali and then kind of, you know, wish everybody well and conclude the session. But this year we had our public relations, Chandra Venkat, who put forth the idea and said, why don't we actually have professional fireworks? And then, you know, we all kind of looked at each other and said, really? Can we really do that? So in November...
After explaining the importance of Diwali to the city of Shawnee, the temple was given permission to present a fireworks display on November 6th. The Hindu temple sees it as a chance to reach out and share with the non-Hindu community of Kansas City. While it's not a free-for-all like in India, the Indian-born temple members look forward to sharing Diwali fireworks with their children as they remember the holiday from their youth.
People are setting off these things, whether they are kind of, you know, small bombs or, to rockets. So sometimes kids, I have done it myself, I'm guilty of it, where they kind of put rockets inside bottles and then light them. And then, oh, by the way, the bottle kind of tips over and then the rocket goes horizontally. It might hit somebody in the process and people yell at you. But then it's actually, you know, part of the spirit of celebrating Diwali. And even now when we call home on Diwali, people can't even hear us because there's loud fireworks going on in the background. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of funny, you know, very nostalgic memories growing up.
Alex and Sylvia reported on Diwali in Kansas City back in 2010. We thank you for tuning in to KC Currents this week. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
We've also got a podcast. You can find that at kcur.org or on iTunes. Contact us at kcurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kcurrents.
KC Currents is produced by Suzanne Hogan and Alex Smith. Our senior producer is Sylvia Maria Gross. Zach Lewandowski is our intern, and our theme music is by Approach. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith.